My name is Artley Snuff, and I was on campus August 1st, 1966. I had just gotten out of high school in May of 66 from Austin High, and I was going to school that summer to get my freshman English requirements out of the way. I still lived at home. I was very unworldly and didn't know much about the world. I'd never seen a dead body. The only thing I knew about guns were from Western movies or World War II movies. Austin was less than a tenth the size it is now. It was maybe 150, 180,000 people, and it seemed like a small town. It seemed like everybody knew everybody else's business, and if you didn't know somebody, you knew somebody that knew them. When you looked at the skyline of Austin, the skyline of Austin consisted of two things, of the University Tower and the Capitol Dome. What Scarborough's is what, six stories tall? Maybe there was no other skyline but the tower and the Capitol back then. All the guys, you'd see a lot of loafers in white socks. The girls, you'd see a lot of dresses and wearing nylons to class. Looking back, it just seems like it was very idyllic. Certainly for me, it was a time of innocence. And August 1st was a day that that innocence was lost. I went home for lunch, or went over to a friend's co-op for lunch. It was the Stag Co-op at the southwest corner of 21st and Rio Grande. And we were playing chess there, listening to KNRW Radio, the top 40 station. They played the Beach Boys and the Beatles and the Yardbirds. And we were listening, and somebody came on, one of the DJs came on the radio there shortly before noon and said that he thought that there was somebody with an air rifle on top of the tower. And we thought that sounded more interesting than what we were doing, so we went over to campus. We entered campus. I wasn't wearing a watch. I don't know exactly on the times for the rest of this. We entered the campus on the Intercampus Drive at 22nd and Guadalupe and walked towards the main building. And just as we got right on campus, there was somebody standing about where the loading dock of the post office is now, waving at us and saying, "Get out of the street. You know, hide yourself." And that was the first time we noticed that something was amiss. And so we rushed into the, to our right was Sutton Hall. We went into Sutton Hall, which was an education building, I believe, then. Now it's architecture. We went up to the third floor of Sutton Hall and all the way to the office on the east side of the top floor. And from there, through the windows, you can look out, and through the tree canopy, you could see people were lying on the mall and needed help. And we knew we couldn't do anything in that office, so the fellow I'd been playing chess with, by the way, James Love was his name. He was also, James Love and I had graduated from Austin High together in 1966. And James and I went down from that office at the top of Sutton Hall, back out to the Intercampus Drive and over towards the main mall, where we stayed under the where the statue of Jefferson Davis was. It was still there then, but it's been taken down now, of course, for obvious reasons. The firing of the rifle we could hear from the moment we entered campus, and it continued. It was real hot that day. I think it was a 100-degree day, and I, like an idiot, was wearing black clothing. And with the adrenaline and the heat, I was not in any kind of shade there under the statue. I became dizzy and nauseous. I think I was suffering, starting to suffer some minor symptoms of heat stroke. So I crawled into, there used to be some tall hedges along the Intercampus Drive then. They've been taken down since. I crawled under those hedges so I could get a better get control of myself, and so I could cool down. So when I crawled out from under those hedges, and I looked back at the people that were still lying on the mall, one of them, the girl that was always I was always looking at, she was obviously very pregnant, and I could tell she was I could tell she was alive because she was moving, her legs were moving, and I worried that if the shooter on the tower saw her, that she might be shot again. And when I crawled out from under the hedge, I realized that I had the opportunity to get into shade and to revive myself. But they didn't have that opportunity. They'd been laying there under the hot sun, on the hot concrete. She was obviously wounded. The people around her looked dead. And the tower kept chiming every 15 minutes. And I would think, 15 more minutes they've been out there. 15 more minutes. So the time came. There was another fellow that ran out first. He tapped a fellow on the shoulder that had been laying out in the middle of the mall. And they ran towards the inner campus drive. The fellow that had been laying down crumpled as they went down the stairs. And he rolled down the stairs to the sidewalk there, across from the George Washington statue. And when I ran out from cover, from behind where the Jefferson Davis statue was, I ran towards them. I ran to him. I ran parallel to the inner campus drive to where he was. And he was there with another fellow, and I realized that I was now out from undercover, and time was wasting. James was right next to me, James Love, and James and I ran from there at the sidewalk of the inner campus drive across from the George Washington statue. We ran straight out to the people that were laying on the middle of the ball. Pardon me. I grabbed Claire's ankles, and James grabbed her wrist. And we picked her up and started carrying her to safety, to the area behind the Jefferson Davis statue. And it seemed like time passed very slow. I knew I might die when I went out. But it was intolerable to leave those people laying out there. So as we carried Claire to safety, we had to go. You have to go down those stairs between the main mall and the sidewalk down there. And I was sweating like a pig. It was 100 degree temperature. I was still dressed in black clothing. And as we went down the stairs, my glasses, I'm legally blind without my glasses, and they started sliding down my nose. They were big, like Buddy Holly looking thick glass lenses. And as we went down, they fell off my face as we went down those stairs. And so James and I set Claire down on the sidewalk. And I had to go back out from cover to find and pick up my glasses because everything was a blur. I can't find my way out of a room without my glasses. I wear contacts now, but back then, big, thick glasses. And since we set Claire down, four or five other students that were there behind under the Jefferson Davis statue picked up Claire and took her down to where the ambulance was. And James Love and I watched. There was another fellow that carried Claire's boyfriend, Tom Ekman, who had died. He'd been hit in the neck and had bled out over the hour and a half that he laid out there. I remember seeing his face. I'd never seen a complexion with such pallor. It was like an alabaster statue. It was so white and pale. He was laying on the sidewalk next to the bloodstain of Officer Billy Paul Speed, who'd been shot right there and died So I helped pick up the I helped pick up Tom Ekman, and we carried him down to the ambulance. And after that, I went back to this where the statue, the Jefferson Davis statue, was, and it was over shortly after that, I think. I don't know what the passage of time was, but I remember looking up at the tower and seeing it looked like a flag being waved. It turned out I talked to one of the policemen later, and it was a towel being tied to the end of a rifle barrel. Students had gone home and gotten their deer rifles and had been firing back at the tower the whole time while the incident had taken place. And they were now putting the lives of the officers that had gone up there to put down the shooter in danger. Eventually, the deer rifle shots finally died down after the white towel was waved, and the mall gradually filled with people. First a few, then a dozen, then hundreds, and then it seemed like thousands. And it was over. There were gunshots coming from all parts of campus, so I couldn't tell his shots from the deer rifle student shots. It was, and for all the time that I was there under the statue of Jefferson Davis, there was gunshots all over campus. There'd be a burst and then maybe a pause, and then they would pick up again. When you look at newsreels of that day, and you see what looks like puffs of smoke, it's not smoke. They had smokeless gunpowder already by 1966. It's not like an old Western. What you're seeing is the limestone being pulverized by shots from below. Those are shots coming in from students' deer rifles, firing at the top of the tower and pulverizing the stone. That's not gun smoke. The first shot that Whitman fired from the tower was hit Claire, and the second one hit her boyfriend Tom Ekman. And he had time. Nobody was reacting to shots before she was the first one hit. So strangely, one of the reasons she lived was that he had a scope. He must have honed in on her pregnant child, on her pregnancy, on her fetus. It's the child's skull was fractured. He must have chosen that spot on purpose, and I don't know why. I assume the first shot that was fired from the tower was the one that hit Claire, that hit her fetus. And that was, I believe, was fired at 11:48. There's one thing. I remember when we were in Sutton Hall, on the top floor of Sutton Hall, and looking through the canopy of branches and first saw the people laying on the mall. And moved up to the statue, and you know, I knew Claire was alive because I could see her move. I was worried that Whitman would see her and shoot her again. But she was the only one I remember seeing move, and I assumed all the rest of the people were dead. When we ran out there, when the moment arrived, and we went out to carry people, there was one girl that was laying there that I assumed was a dead body, suddenly jumped up, grabbed her purse, and started running off faster than me. She had been a student who was right after Claire was shot, came over to her and laid down next to Claire and talked to her to keep her awake. Gosh, to lay there during that whole episode, right where people had been shot and killed, and to lay there with Claire and keep her talking, keep her aware, keep her from sliding away. That to me is a very special person. She's passed away now, and I think there's a very special place in heaven for a woman that would do that. But I wasn't scared, but I've never been more startled when she jumped up, grabbed a purse, and took off. You can see it in the newsreel footage. I thought she was dead. To lay there on that hot concrete. To keep Claire talking, I thought was a very giving moment. And I can't imagine anyone doing that. I knew I might die when I ran out. I'd never been more scared. But if you looked up, if you could see Whitman, he could see you, and he had a rifle. So I focused mainly on the people lying on the mall. It seemed slow at the time. Time seemed like it was moving very slow, like molasses. I remember thinking, I can feel a spot in my back right now. I remember thinking that if I was going to be shot, it would be in my backbone, right between my shoulder blades. And I can feel that spot right now. It's about the size of a coin. It's a little tingly spot. And it's, when I talk about this and when I think about it, I can feel that spot because when we were running away from the tower, with our backs to the tower carrying Claire, that was, I remember the thought passed through my mind at that point is that would be the spot that I would be hit. He was very accurate. Most people were hit in the head or torso. I should have gone out earlier. I understand it's a phenomenon that people that go through something like this feel guilt. I waited an hour too long. I've seen tapes of one of the officers that went up the tower and stopped the shooting. Felt he should have done it faster as well. It's supposed to be a phenomenon, and be that as it may, I do feel it, and it's strong within me. Now, I still feel grief, not only for the people that died, but for the fact that of my cowardice. Because it took me so long. It took me an hour of waiting before I went and got Claire off the mall. because of me, she had to lay out there for another hour of pain. I wish I'd gone out earlier. I should have run out when I first got there. When you think about it, looking back, the odds were 3-1 in my favor because it's a four-sided tower. It was after I crawled out from under the hedge, after I'd gotten myself back together, that I realized that they could not get the comfort that I'd gotten from the shadow, and that they needed something needed to be done. There was no police there. There was no ambulance techs where I was, and the Jefferson Davis statue was. We were only about 100 feet away. It felt like you could almost reach out and touch them, but they were suffering and they were in pain. And something had to be done. Of course, it was an aberrant event, and he had an aberrant mind. He'd been taking a lot of amphetamines, which doesn't help conditions of paranoia and rage. The man must have had a lot of rage inside of him. The footlocker that he carried up there, he had lots of long rifles. There was a Luger. He had other handguns. He had food, he had water, he had a transistor radio. He was listening to Neil Speltz on the radio while he was shooting. He was listening to Neil Speltz reporting the event live from the ground. He also, I think, had a gallon and a half or several gallons of gasoline that you can only speculate as to what he was going to do with that. Perhaps he was going to do something after dark with it. I don't know. But when you look at what he did, and he also carried more amphetamines up there with him, he did not expect to come down alive. I think it was a form of suicide by police. I want to say that James and I were not the only ones to do what we did that day. All along Guadalupe, you had people helping the fallen, the dead and wounded. It was, I think the only reason I was caught on camera is because it was later in the siege when I ran out. Most of the people that were shot in the first 10 or 15 minutes. I think after that, everybody had enough sense to stay inside. And the Austin Police Department was putting a perimeter, cordoning off the university. Well, there was a couple of dozen students under the statue of Jefferson Davis and under the statue of Woodrow Wilson right across the mall. We could see each other. There were people. There were dozens of people in Parlin Hall right behind us. I don't know what went on behind me. It was strange looking back. It was KLRU back then. KLRN broadcast live, and I believe there were live broadcast. My wife, who was in San Antonio at the time, remembers seeing it live on PBS in San Antonio. I didn't realize that it was what was happening was being televised. I didn't realize that the police were putting up cordons behind me. I didn't understand where all the gunfire was coming from behind me. I have to look at the footage now, and it seems strange that that people were watching live. There wasn't a lot of live TV back in 1966. Looking back on it, all those students with deer rifles that were firing at the tower may have been one of the largest unofficial vigilante posses in American history. They took the law into their own hands and started firing back at the tower. I'm sure what they thought they were doing was right. They did end up endangering the lives of the police officers, but it was vigilantism. On campus that day. On that day, I believe that the University of Texas student body was better armed than the Austin Police Department, which were equipped with pistols and the occasional shotgun. There was no SWAT teams. We didn't know at the time that three other members of our high school graduating class had been shot that day, two of which died, Paul Sontag and Claudia Rutt. One thing I remember audio-wise from the incident is something I've never heard before since, unless you hear news reports from, say, Beirut or Damascus or Tripoli or Sarajevo, urban gunfire. There's a quality of sound to the urban gunfire where it echoes. There are buildings placed different distances from you and at different angles, and so there's a strange echoey effect when you hear gunfire in an urban setting. And I heard it that day, and I hope I never hear it again. That day, August 1st of 1966, was on a Monday, and they closed school on Tuesday to clean up the blood, and UT reopened on Wednesday. These days, when you get Newtown or Columbine, you have a flood of psychoanalysts go in to help people talk it out. Nothing like that was. It was a simpler time, and nothing like that happened then. I knew people that evidently had been on campus that day, and we knew each other, but we never talked about it. And I didn't know for years later that we were both on campus at the same time. I think people were sort of stunned, and it was, I think that one of the reasons nobody talked much about it is because they were stunned, because they went mute at the thought of what had happened. I think at the time we figured it was a one-off, that it was a random event that would never occur again. We were unfortunately very wrong there. The legacy, I think, that Whitman has given is a legacy that he has given other disturbed minds a template of action in which to express themselves, to go out with a bang or whatever. I know that people that are listening to this, that within the next week there will be a mass murder in the United States. We don't know where or who, but it happens on a regular basis now, and it's we thought back then in 1966 that a school shooting was so horrendous and rare that we would never be discussing school shootings on a regular basis like we are now. Later that afternoon, when everything was over, everything was finished, I walked around the side of a building and suddenly saw the tower. And it took everything I had within me not to throw myself under a stone bench. We'd spent all that time staring at the tower with fear. And it was strange emotions well up after something like that's over. I didn't think about it much at the time. You could also see from where I was for that hour, you could see the inscription on the south side of the main building. "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And to me, one of the truths I discovered that day are there is monsters that live among us. There are people there are people that think unthinkable thoughts and do unthinkable things. And they're out there. And there's more good than bad, but there are monsters that walk among us. I rarely talk about it. To stand up in front of an audience and sing, I'm not that good with music. Anything I did would be to trivialize it. You know, like what Kinky Freeman did. To me, it's a moment to it's to honor the people that fell. It's I wouldn't go into a cemetery and play a song either. It's a moment that I think of with reverence rather than my band's a more of a comedy band anyway. I like to make people smile. I would have liked to have seen a memorial before now. I'm just glad that they've decided to go ahead and to do the right thing. I think that a memorial is the right thing to do. There are still friends and families of all those people that died that day here in town, and I think it will help give closure to those friends and families. It'll be a place where you can go and sit on a bench and look at the names of the fallen, light a candle, and express your grief or your feelings in whatever way you deem fit. And I think it's nice that it'll be next to the Turtle Pond. It's a nice, quiet, pastoral place, and I think it's the last. There's not many places with a good full view of the tower, and I think it's apt that the university is agreeing to put up that memorial now. To me, the real heroes that day were Alan Crum and the members of the Austin Police Department. They were the ones that climbed the tower and put a stop to it. Officer Billy Paul Speed was hit while standing underneath the statue of Jefferson Davis. The bullet came between the balustrades to hit him. And to me, since that pedestal is now vacant, since Jefferson Davis's statue has been removed for obvious reasons, I would like to see a statue of Billy Paul Speed. He died. Officer Speed died while protecting the university community, which is more than you can say about any other statue on campus. I think it would be nice if the university honored him by doing that. One good thing that came out of the incident was, to me, the fact that SWAT teams evolved. And I think the growth of the EMS technology was hurried because of the incident that day. So in that sense, something good came out of it. The more I've been talking about it over the last few years, I think that's been good for me. It's helped me to express myself better and to come in to connect with the emotions and the feelings that are within me. It's been a catharsis to talk about it and to meet Claire and to move towards the 50th anniversary day. Oh, well, her name was in the paper the next day. You know, the Life magazine and Time magazine had cover stories on it in the next week. I didn't meet Claire until just a few years ago. Social media, Facebook and the internet makes it easier for people to connect with others that you haven't seen in decades. And it played a part. And we both had a mutual friend on Facebook. And we met down in South Austin at El Gallo at a Mexican food restaurant. And we met down there a few years back and hugged each other for a long time. We had a mutual friend, a fellow named Forrest Priest, and that we'd both met online. And Forrest got us together. And I think she finally called me, I believe. And we agreed to get together and have dinner. I remember looking at her and saying that she looked a lot better than the last time I'd seen her. It's my understanding that that campus advocates of campus carry on both sides of campus carry are planning demonstrations for that day, and I will not be a part of either demonstration that I know of. I will be at the unveiling. To me, I think it's an ironic nexus that the Texas legislature's law goes into effect on August 1st. I don't think they planned it that way. I think a lot of laws take effect that day. But to me, as I say, it's an ironic nexus that those two events occur at the same time. It's unfortunate. When people talk about a bad guy with a gun, the solution is a good guy with a gun. As a solution, you'd think perhaps somebody with military service, someone that had extensive firearms training in the military, that perhaps someone like that might be a good person to turn to. Well, you've just described Charles Whitman. You've just described Lee Harvey Oswald. You've described the doctor up in Fort Hood. To me, it's the quantity of guns out there that's the problem, and I don't know any solution. Hopefully, it'll be a phase that we go through. I would like to think that in the future, that people will look back upon this period of history and say, well, the fascination with guns was popular then, but it died out. I would like to see that. I'd like to see it today. When you talk about campus carry, with the students with deer rifles, that was the most egregious example of campus carry that I can think of. And people say that a bad guy with a gun can be helped with a good guy with a gun. I disagree with that thought. I believe that if a police officer shows up, he's not going to be able to tell the good guy from the bad guy. And to me, the good guys are the men and women that wear the patch of the Austin Police Department. And I don't understand this surge of vigilantism that seems to be sweeping the nation, and certainly has swept through the Texas legislature. I think that's it. Hopefully, I'm all cried out. I'm getting better when I talk about it. Yeah. Well, it was a terrible day, but I think it helped Austin. The people that were on campus then, I think, formed a stronger community because of it. It's like combat soldiers, a sharing of memories of trials and tribulation together, I think, intensified for the university community back then. And you find people that it's like the day Kennedy was shot. Everybody in Austin knew what they were doing on the day that happened. Everybody has a story that's above a certain age that was here then. And I guess that's my story.